Everyone, welcome to minute 69 of season 8 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Professor Sam Edwards of Loughborough University, an associate professor of modern history. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
It's been a very, very fun 5 days with you. Very informative, very educational. Unfortunately, today's the last day that you're going to be with us this season, but still, I'm sure we have what to talk about.
Absolutely, yeah. It's been good talking about you. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so minute 69 begins with Miller realizing that this is pretty much a no-win conversation and ends with Reagan giving his opinion. So yesterday we ended things with Mike and Miller were having a conversation about the ultimate goal of sending soldiers into battle. You know, who's worth it, who's not. Is this mission worth anything or anything like that? And you know, they sort of have, I wouldn't necessarily say an argument, but they have a discussion as to whether the life of Ryan is as worthy of being saved as some other men that that they've discussed that are no longer with us. But they don't come to a conclusive decision as to whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just this is life. This is the situation. And right at the beginning of this minute, Miller just he realizes that this conversation is not going to go anywhere. And he basically says, now look, we're going to move out in 2 hours. Why don't you get some sleep? And, you can see that he's also avoiding Mike's question, because Mike asks him right beforehand about his hand, why it's shaking. So he sort of like changes the subject and says, maybe you should get some sleep. Now it's funny that he emphasizes the word you. You know, he doesn't say maybe we should get some sleep. Which tells us a lot also about the psychological effects that Miller has from everything that's going on. You know, here he is sitting here in this church deciding, resting, but for him, resting isn't necessarily sleep. And it only happens when he's not in the middle of combat or action or anything like that. You know, whenever he needs to react, then he doesn't think about these things. He's still just working on instinct and is able to go and do his duty without a problem. But when he has these moments of downtime, that's when these things are starting to surface.
Yeah. The demons come in at the night, right? Yeah, so these are the moments of reflection where he tries to avoid, clearly, the rest, the sleep, one suspects, because of what he fears he might encounter. There's also a little bit of a hint here, I guess, as well, of his commitment to his job, which is, he's the boss, and you can get some sleep, but I got stuff to do. I got a duty here. A little bit of a sense of his kind of, again, him carrying that burden of command.
Right, that's true. He also does need to find a way to relax. He does know that he needs. This isn't something that he can completely avoid, but I guess I'm assuming it's taking a toll on him, the fact of what just happened last week with this wrong Private Ryan. My assumption is that he's also not taking that so lightly, the fact that he sort of now just ruined someone else's life, I guess you can say, or at least for the time being. We don't know how long that will affect that particular James Frederick Ryan, but he's in distress right now, and Miller knows that he's at fault for that, because he didn't do his enough due diligence to make sure that he had the right Ryan before he did that. It's a name that's he probably should have thought about how many James Ryans there might be.
Yeah, that's
relatively
fair.
common name. It's not, it's not the most common name. It's not like his name is John Smith or something like that. But still, it's it's something that he probably should have gotten somewhat of an idea about.
Yeah, that's fair.
But yeah,
But I
so.
guess given circumstances and situation and his desire to complete the mission, to get it done, because he's frustrated by it, right? So it's like, ah, there's Ryan, there's a James Ryan. Okay, yeah, let's our job's done now. And but as you say, it's the wrong Ryan.
No, but again, the idea of going a little into the future as to what he's going to say later on about the mission, it's very interesting to see that he's basically, he still wants to do this mission as efficiently and as quickly as possible. And that's the strange thing here, because if he's looking at the way that this whole thing is playing out, his mission is not something that is going to make a decision about what's happening in the war. He has a minor mission that needs to be taken care of that is completely inconsequential to the overall picture of what's going on in Europe.
Yeah.
As we stated yesterday, his mission is to help Mrs. Ryan. That's what it is. Mrs. Ryan is, in the middle of Iowa. She's not on the front. It doesn't matter to her if Hitler wins or loses, or which of the whether it's the Third Army that makes it to Berlin first or no one cares. She doesn't care about those things. She cares about getting her son back from alive, and that's basically his mission. His mission has nothing to do with the war itself. It's to get someone out of the war. Obviously, you need to go through a bunch of different hurdles to get there that are related to the war. So, you think from Miller's perspective, it doesn't matter how long it takes him to get this mission done. Obviously, time is of the essence because he wants to get Jimmy Ryan before he gets killed. That makes sense too. But it's not as if this will either shorten or prolong the war.
And that's kind of his frustration as well, right? That there's a worthiness to the mission, but at the same time, it's not what he's there for. Yeah.
Well, he's there to do whatever his office, the commanders above him, want him to do.
Yeah, to win the war, to get home. Yeah.
So you're saying from that perspective that maybe his frustration is that why am I being given a mission like this? I want to be on a mission that will help win the war, as
That's the
opposed
sense
to
I get. Yeah, some of his
make
frustration is
Mrs.
about,
Ryan
yeah. Yeah,
happy.
that's a little bit, yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. There is something to that. And at this point, the scene changes, and we see a bunch of the squad just sitting around. None of them obviously are able to sleep except for Jackson, who is completely fast asleep at that point. And Ryben just looks over at him and goes, "I don't know how he does it." And Melish asks, "What's that?" He goes, "Falls asleep like that. I mean, look at him. The guy's lights out the minute his head hits the pack." Melish just looks at him and goes, "Clear conscience." So, I mean, it's an interesting way to look at it from that perspective, because we know that Jackson is a religious man. So maybe from that perspective, it works. But the whole idea is that sometimes when you're really tired, doesn't matter what situation you're in, if you have a few moments to rest, you're gonna do that.
You take it,
Yeah, exactly.
but as you say, what we then learn as the scene builds is that at least his comrades think that his faith plays a role in some of this as well, because it clear conscience, and then they talk about if God's on your side,
That's right.
is that the
Yeah,
way? Yeah.
that's the. Then Riven says, "Yeah, what's that saying? If God's on our side, who the hell could be on theirs?"
Yeah.
Which is a great quote. Do you know where that quote is from?
Remind me.
Okay. Well, I, again, I I personally only believe in the Old Testament, not the New Testament, but it is from the New Testament. It's from Romans 8:31. And the quote is, if God is for us, who can be against us?
Yes, sir.
He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us things?
And it's, and this is another really interesting bit of the film then, because, and we talked about this over the last few days, how Spielberg drops into some of these scenes, some really kind of big issues, some big things that have received a lot of discussion and attention over the years. And one of them that we've talked about is combat motivation, is what motivated the troops. And certainly for some, faith was a key part of it. Certainly the US Army that goes to war in 1941-42, and there's a lot of effort put in to ensure that the spiritual needs of the soldiers are looked after. The US Chaplaincy Service, that part of the military, it expands massively to ensure that, you know, chaplains can go go into theatre with the troops. And so there's a little bit of a hint of that there, the role that that God plays for the soldiers of Uncle Sam when they go to war in 41-42.
Yeah, for sure, and it makes a lot of sense, you know, and that's also the, you know, you even see that when you look at pictures of, you know, in the movie, you can see it in the bookend scenes, you know, in the cemetery, but even if you look at any real pictures from the cemetery, you see the crosses, you see the stars.
Absolutely,
you know, showing that you know, there is some religious conviction here also.
It's and it's really interesting because. So when the United States goes to war in 1917, during World War One, there's a lot of emphasis put in some of the kind of propaganda and some of the speeches of a kind of a religiosity that's kind of a crusade to make the world safe for democracy is how the government of Woodrow Wilson will kind of shape that conflict. A conflict later, World War II, 41-42, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt is much more wary about invoking that kind of very kind of religious language, at least in terms of kind of justifying and saying this is why the troops are going to war. But it nonetheless is there, and it lingers around the edges, and it comes out when, for instance, Dwight D. Eisenhower publishes after the war his memoirs of the conflict, the title of which is, very deliberately, Crusade in Europe, which picks up on the very language that Eisenhower uses in the message he sends to all Allied troops when they're bombing around in the English Channel on the 5th of June 1944, and that is that this, you know, you are about to embark upon the Great Crusade is the language Ike uses to describe D-Day. So there's a little bit of a hint of all of that just in this one little scene here.
Well, that could also come from the perspective that, you know, Roosevelt was a Democrat and Eisenhower was a Republican, and then obviously when you look at it from a political perspective, so the Democrats are the party that tries not to deal with religion, and the Republicans are the ones who don't have a problem talking about religion from that perspective.
I think it's a little bit of that, and I think it's also though a kind of a caution about, we used that language in World War One and it didn't work out, and there were you know, it was a conflict which did not make the world safe for democracy ultimately, and which, you know, and which is very much connected to World War II. So I think there's a kind of real caution around in 41-42 about how to mobilize, the kind of language to use, how to describe what's at stake.
Right. Okay. I mean that makes a lot of sense also. And you know, after you know, Upham corrects Ryben and gives him the real quote. If God be for us, who could be against us? So Ryben goes, yeah, what did I say? Meaning, this is exactly what I said. why do you even have to correct me? You know, I said it perfectly. You know,
and the other bit I love about it is there's a reference in there, right? I think that Spielberg referencing not just the Bible and not just that sense of the religiosity of American combat troops in World War II, but I think he's also, there's a little hint there of Longest Day, right? Because there's a couple of scenes in The Longest Day where a similar thing is broached, a similar issue of whose side is God on, mm-hmm. is explored in that film as well. And there's this wonderful kind of parallel scenes of I think it's an American officer in dock in Portsmouth or Southampton or somewhere, and then it flips to Rommel in Normandy on the eve of D-Day, but they're all asking the same question, you know, whose side is God on? And the reason in that film the question gets provoked is because of the storm raging, and so the Allies are like, yeah, I thought God's on our side. If God's on our side, why is this storm raging and stopping us from invading? Yeah.
And you also have the point in The Longest Day with the with the preacher, you know, who
Yes.
loses his he's
Yes.
trying to find his
Communion
little
box. Yeah,
communion
yeah.
box exactly in the river, you know.
Yeah.
Again, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, as I'm sure you know this much better than I do, but religion plays a very large part in many, many wars over history.
Absolutely.
And the idea is my God better than your God, or is my God more powerful than your God, or things like that. But here you sort of run into a problem where it's more or less the same God. So it's like, okay, you know, which side is God going to be on if we both believe in the same one, you know, from that perspective. So it's, again, it's a nice way to drop that in here, as you said. I like that. I like the way that they do that. And Wade then just sort of changes the subject a little bit. They're still talking about sleeping, but and he goes, well, actually, the trick to falling asleep is trying to stay awake. And Robin looks at him and goes, how's that, Wade? He says, well, when my mother was an intern, she used to work late through the night, sleep through the day. So the only time that we ever got to talk about anything was when she'd get home. So what I used to do, I used to lie in my bed and try to stay awake as long as I could. But it never worked, because the harder I tried, the faster I'd fall asleep. And, you know, it's, again, we don't know how old he was at the time, you know, whether it's talking about that he's a little kid or whatever, but it tells us a lot about Wade himself, because it says if his mother was an intern, so it means his mother maybe is some sort of doctor,
yep.
Which could then have been possibly a motivation for him to want to be, you know, want to be a medic, want to do this type of work or whatever. It also makes it sound, and again, you know, it's just my conjecture on this, that he was probably an only child to a single mother.
Entirely possible. Yeah.
It's the way it makes it sound. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. We'll never know, because it's not really something that's explained. But based on this quote from him, it makes it sound that way. That it's just the two of them. You know, the two of them on his own, and for him to be able to, because he doesn't say, oh, well, I had to take care of my other siblings, or my father was still around, or anything like that. He just talks about his mother and that type of thing. And, you know, it was so important for him to try to stay awake, but, you know, as much as he tried to stay awake, he would still fall asleep.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so you get a little sense there, as you say, of his childhood, of family life, of a hint, potentially, of what his mother was doing. And, of course, it also reveals something which was absolutely the case for so many of those troops in combat in World War II, and that is that the home was never far from their thoughts, and especially in those moments of downtime and the reflected bits between the terror and the trauma, yeah, that's where home was, where it came to the fore. You get a little bit of that here.
Yeah, again, most of these guys were very young, obviously, also at the time. Most of them, this is the first time they were away from home.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they volunteered it because they wanted to do their duty to the country. And again, the fact that we know where that they all are, people that are coming from these small little towns, you know, in middle America, you know, and they're coming out of the woodwork in order to be able to go fight for democracy, you know, in this crusade, you know, as you mentioned it, which also is connected to things. So from their perspective, you know, they're doing their duty, but most of them are just right out of high school or not that long afterwards. You know, the novelization says that Wade is 26. I have trouble believing that you know, looking at Giovanni Ribisi and trying to believe that he's supposed to be the oldest of all of these guys in the squad. I don't buy that so much. Also, the way that he talks here, as you said, it makes it sound like just yesterday he was, you know, he was doing this and, you know, falling asleep before his mother got home, you know, that kind of thing. But that's a very good point. And I like that Spielberg touches upon that often throughout this movie. I mean, even just 2 weeks ago when we met the Minnesota Ryan, you know, he talks about the fact that he just sent a letter to his brothers, you know, right before they shipped out.
Yep.
You know, which the assumption is right before the D-Day invasion, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't saying 3 months ago when I was in, you know, before I got on the boat leaving the East Coast. it made it sound as if it was right before, they were getting ready for the D-Day invasion itself, that he just sent the letter to them. Obviously, it's not as instantaneous then as it is today. Today you can send a message, and you and I are thousands of miles away from each other, but we're talking live. But he wasn't able to do a Skype or Zoom call with his little brothers, or Wade with his mother, right before they go to the battle or anything like that. So,
Yeah, it's yeah, as you say, it's, you get a sense of how thoughts of home, thoughts of siblings, thoughts of loved ones are ever present. And the other thing which strikes me about this scene is again, it gives us a deeper understanding of another scene later in the film. Which, where Wade dies, and one of the final things he does in that moment is he calls for his mother, right? And it's clear from those two scenes combined that he has a deep and close relationship with his mother, and that he's thinking about his mum.
right. That's true also. Now, I don't know if you've had a chance to see this, because it just came out a few weeks ago, but there was a recent movie that came out called The 6888.
I just wrote a review for it for a magazine over on this side of the Atlantic just a couple of days ago. So yeah, it's fresh in my mind at the moment.
Okay, so again, that goes exactly with what we were just talking about, the fact that these guys were sending letters, and they weren't going anywhere, and they weren't getting the letters that they were supposed to be getting. And the movie The 6888, which I enjoyed a lot more than I thought I would, because I had read some reviews that were not very good about the movie, but I liked the premise of the movie, that here is a group of women who nobody believes that they're going to be able to do what they're what they give them this impossible task,
They
and
set them up to fail, but they succeed.
right, and what they did was basically raise the morale on both sides of the Atlantic with what they had to do. And that fits in perfectly with what we're talking about here, this whole idea that just sending a letter home was important to these guys, but getting a letter from home was even more important.
Absolutely crucial to morale, and as you say, something that is kind of present in this film, Never Saving Private Ryan. We talked a couple of days ago about the scene in the church at an earlier point. We see someone transcribing a letter, right? Because there's a bloody bit of paper in it, and Wade's transcribing it. So yeah, letter writing, the importance of communication, of sending back home, but also getting things from home, absolutely crucial to morale in World War II.
Exactly. And the minute ends with Reiben getting the last word in, and says, "Yeah, well, that wouldn't have mattered, none in my home." And
And
that's how he's gonna leave it. We're gonna have to wait and find out till tomorrow what exactly Reiben means by that. What is going on in Reiben's house that this story from Wade doesn't make it, wouldn't work.
And all we know, as you say, at this point is that we're led to believe that he had a very different home life to Wade, right? That's what he's intimating here, but we don't know.
Which again makes a lot of sense, because every one of these characters is very different. They have different upbringings. Reiben's the boy from Brooklyn. I don't remember what the novelization says where Wade is from, but Wade is probably, I would say, like from a Midwestern city. Like maybe something in Ohio or Pennsylvania or something like that. That would be my guess. A city, not even a town. And then obviously Jackson is from some little farm somewhere. Mellish, it's harder to say where he's probably from. And Caparzo is probably also somewhere on the East Coast, whether it's Boston or New Jersey or something like that. And it's somewhat iconoclastic, the way that they're all very different, but it tries to give us somewhat of an idea as to the different ways that everyone looked at the world at that point, and their upbringings and stuff like that.
Yeah, as we talk, it's that classic, the squad is melting pot, the American melting pot there, people from coming from all over.
Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute, or anything about the movie in general?
I think we did that that minute. I think we covered all the ground there. But just to say, sort of on the movie itself, what I already said when I did my top five in the last episode, and that is that I think it's a really powerful bit of storytelling. I think it came out at a really interesting moment in time, 1998, in amidst all of that burgeoning nostalgia for World War II, partly connected to the fact that that those that lived and endured it, survived it, were just then in their twilight, in their declining years. And so it's a real kind of marker of its moment, that is the late 1990s, as much as it's a really interesting story for what happened in 1944.
Excellent. All right. So would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
So you can find me on Blue Sky at Sam Edwards at Running Historian.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram. And you can find me on Twitter. So tomorrow I'll be back with the final episode from my guest from last week, Eddie Wright. But until then, I want to once again thank Sam for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us about this movie, probably in a way that you've never talked about movies before.
I've absolutely enjoyed it. It's been a real pleasure, and actually got me thinking far more about how each of these minutes has a real significance to them. So thanks, Rob.
All right, and let me know if you want me to be a co-author on some of your articles.
Agreed.
All right, so I will be back tomorrow. Until then, earn this.
Earn this. My solitude.